You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 5th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio.
Should Europe be shopping elsewhere for ammunition for Ukraine? Has Hungary found something else to be difficult about? And the social media equivalent of the drying out clinic? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Aliona Hlivko and Patty Cohen will discuss today's big stories, and we'll hear from the former Australian politician who learned the hard way that you do not besmirch the reputation of the koala. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Aliona Hlivko, Managing Director at the Henry Jackson Society, former Ukrainian Regional MP, and by Patty Cohen, Global Economics Correspondent at the New York Times. Hello to you both.
Hello there.
Aliona, you have, I understand it, recently made your first ever visit to Dublin, which is one of the great cities to visit at any juncture, but it is one of the great cities to visit for the first time. I still remember my first visit quite well.
Do you now? Mm. I look forward to hearing all about that. Indeed, I had the luxury of taking 3 days off from work and just visiting a lovely city of Dublin, which I found to be an interesting mixture between London life and the Ukrainian feelings, because everyone seems so down to earth and welcoming and just like your old time friend. And that's something I always experience in Ukraine.
Well, maybe everywhere just seems like that compared to London. but yes, it's a fantastic city to visit, and people who haven't should, and people who have should again. And as I say that, I remind myself that it's far too long since I last went. Patty, you have been venturing further afield than that.
Yes, I've just come back from a month-long reporting trip in Asia. And so that was it feels like I've been away a long time.
That is quite a long time.
Yes, and it took me about a week to get back to schedule.
Asia, a big place, obviously. We will be discussing one especially big part of it shortly, but which bits of it did you go to?
I was in Thailand, South Korea, and Malaysia for various stories that I'm working on for the Times.
Have any of these appeared in print yet?
No. Okay. In fact, they haven't even necessarily appeared in my computer yet. but I'm hopeful they will soon.
Well, our big regards to Patty's editors, if they're listening. She's tapping away furiously during the quiet bits, we assure you. But we will start with President Emmanuel Macron, who is visiting the Czech Republic in an attempt to reinvigorate European enthusiasm for equipping Ukraine to defend itself for a third year. Macron will have found an enthusiastic audience in Prague, at least. The Czechs are floating plans for purchasing weapons for Ukraine from outside Europe. President Pieter Pavel, a former general and once chair of NATO's military committee, reckons that if funds are forthcoming, the Czechs can round up nearly a million artillery rounds. Macron gave it the full Macron, warning that we are surely approaching a moment for Europe in which it will be necessary not to be cowardly. Aliona, am I right in imagining that both you and your fellow Ukrainians might think that moment had already arrived some time ago?
Quite some time ago, if not in February 2022, then hopefully yesterday or today at this summit, that the realization has finally come to Europe. The continent is definitely rearming itself. It's reassuring to see that the threat is now being taken seriously, not just with the war that's been waging on the continent for 10 years now, because if I may remind our listeners that Russia has invaded Ukraine in 2014, and that's when the war started. Then at the very least at the prospects of American isolationism and potentially Donald Trump coming into power and threatening withdrawing from NATO and all the other threats where Europe will have to face the challenges that it needs to face today. So it's very reassuring to see that movement.
And Patty, do we get a sense here that there is some actions matching the words? There has been an amount of extra urgency these last few weeks, I think, especially after former and perhaps future President Donald Trump airily suggested that he would wave Russia into any NATO territory that displeased him. But you know, we've heard Macron vaguely floating the prospect of sending actual troops. Is there a sense that things may be about to ratchet even further up?
I mean, I'm not sure that even though the certainly the nervousness or anxiety has increased, that that signals any more unity among Europe. And in fact, it seems to me that Trump's very disturbing sentiments about perhaps withdrawing support from Europe has shown some of the cracks within the European Union and within NATO in terms of strategy and such. I mean, just to go back as a reminder, the Western countries had promised Ukraine 1 million shells last year, which was a promise that was always questionable whether they could make, simply because they hadn't been producing that many shells. And so you had a big kind of transfer at the beginning of the war, which were stockpiles. But now, you know, they have to produce more, and a lot of countries just don't have them. And there's a long lead time in terms of weaponry. So this is actually coming through on a promise that was made last year. And given also, you know, a lot of the reports coming out, particularly from Germany as well, who and Scholz has reiterated his point that he does not see any Germans or NATO troops going into Ukraine. I think you are seeing how there are splits, you know, among the other nations in Europe about how much to commit and how much Russia threatens their own security.
Aliona, the Czechs seem to think that these million shells can be scared up in a matter of weeks if the funds are forthcoming. That would obviously be helpful to Ukraine's cause. But from what you've been hearing, the shortages of ammunition or the holdups in ammunition, is that already beginning to have an actual impact on the front lines?
It's been having an impact on the front lines for a couple of months now, at the very least. Talking to many soldiers on the front line, talking immediately to my brother, he's been saying to me that the number of shells, Ukrainians versus Russians, are 1 to 10. So imagine if they fire 10 times at you, you're only able to respond once during the day. So the situation is quite troubling at the front line, hence the loss of the territory. And Russians are still advancing in the east of Ukraine. And that is troubling to see. In terms of scaling up production, yes, it's absolutely possible to do in the matters of weeks. When I was at the Reagan Defense Forum in California late last year, some defense companies present there said that as soon as the U.S. Congress passes the supplemental for Ukraine, they can scale up the production within weeks. And up to a month, they can produce 1 million of shells. With the European continent, there are two obstacles. Number one, about 40% of ammunition produced on the continent is still being exported outside of Europe, not to Ukraine. So that needs to be redirected, or at least they need to rethink of the priorities. And secondly, there was always this preference, especially in France, to only manufacture weapons and produce them with EU money within the EU, which is economically sound. But I think at the extreme situation like this, with the war raging on the continent, they are finally perhaps exploring the options to buy those shells elsewhere. And commence the production even in the United States while the Congress is still dragging its feet on approving aid to Ukraine.
Just finally on this, Patty, and to follow up something to which you alluded earlier, and this may have been, I think, the subtext of Macron's suggestion that this is not the time to be cowardly in terms of who he may have been thinking of in particular. How big a backstage row do we imagine has been occasioned by the leak of those conversations among German Luftwaffe brass?
Oh, I mean, according to the reports that I was reading today, actually, it sounds like somebody just literally dialed into the phone call, and it was kind of a conference call, and nobody noticed that it did not sound to be some, you know, incredibly sophisticated hacking operation, and that they weren't speaking on a not secure line. So, you know, there's been a few revelations that have come out, and I think it's very, very disturbing, and it's again showing up in highlighting some of the cracks, and these certainly aren't helping close those cracks.
Actually, just a final thought on this, Alyona, because I know this probably seems quite surreal to a lot of Ukrainians, these sort of strange internecine bickerings going on among European nations while your country is fighting for its survival. But does this stuff register in Ukrainian media? Would the Taurus Gate scandal, which I think is what we're calling it, have registered with Ukrainians at all?
It has, in fact. The Ukrainians are extremely politically savvy. I think we've learned to be that following our autocracy transforming into democracy, all the political movements. And we've also learned to watch European countries and what's going on there, who's under Russian influence, who's on our side. So the Taurus Gate is definitely reverberating within the Ukrainian society. The, you know, unpronounced competition between France and the UK and who would announce boots on the ground first, for which purpose. The, I suppose, suggested cowardly, the alleged cowardly position of Germany that maybe President Macron meant. All of that is being broadly discussed in Ukraine.
Well, let's move along to semi-related news, because Hungary, having at last caved on Sweden's accession to NATO, seems to have found something else about which to start a fight with absolutely everybody. Hungary's Foreign Minister Peter Szijjártó has suggested that his country would not support the prospect of outgoing Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte as NATO's next Secretary General. Rutte is the favourite of the NATO old school and indeed of such bookmakers as Offer Odds, but Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban has apparently not forgotten Rutte's threat circa 2021 to bring Hungary to its knees, unquote, if it didn't get with the programme vis-a-vis gay rights. Patty, do we think Hungary, I know this is the eternal question whenever Hungary takes one of its stands, are they serious about this or are they just trying to milk it for what they can get out of it before they buckle as they usually eventually do?
I think that, you know, it's very difficult to say exactly what's going to happen, because even though Hungary is kind of an outlier, certainly in terms of democratic processes in the among the European Union, there are several other countries that have not come out already and supported Rutte, mm-hmm. particularly the Baltics. And there is this feeling that, you know, kind of the former Eastern European countries that were allied with the old Soviet Union have a kind of second-class status. And there is resentment about that. And there's been a lot of talk about how the major positions, whether in NATO or the European Union, have disproportionately gone to kind of the old line Western European powers and, you know, Britain, Germany, France. And so it is possible that he will get some support, although for different reasons. But in the ultimately, it's the U.S. that kind of has, you know, the major say on who gets that position. And the wild card, as you mentioned, is Donald Trump. I mean, this particular story is not unrelated to some of those, you know, fissures that we were discussing before.
Well, indeed not. Alyona, Mark Rutte, to further Patty's point, would be, if I've counted correctly, the Netherlands' fourth NATO Secretary General. So they can't really complain they haven't had a decent go. And the Netherlands, as more than one current or former Baltic politician has rather briskly pointed out to me personally in recent weeks, has not cleared the 2% spending threshold of GDP since, I think, the early 1990s. I'm sure Ukraine would be perfectly sympathetic to the idea of somebody from perhaps further east stepping up to NATO's top job, but do you buy the idea, which seems to be conventional wisdom among NATO, that this would be a provocation too far, that Russia would get really upset if NATO's next Secretary General was not merely perhaps from the former Warsaw Pact, but heaven help us, from the former actual Soviet Union?
I think we definitely need to get over whatever the red lines should be for Moscow and just try and trigger those, because that's at least as much fun as we can have in these troubling times. With regards to Rutte, of course, Netherlands are quite spoiled, as are all northern states. I think they're getting quite a lot of flag from NATO. As you rightly mentioned, only Eastern European states that are NATO members are actually meeting the 2% and 3% mm-hmm. of GDP spending on defense. But of course, that's because they're on the front line. They're the first flank that will get attacked if Putin listens to Trump's urges to go ahead and invade. So they're, of course, trying to be very vigilant. From what I can see, of course, as Patty rightly mentioned, the U.S. will be the main decision maker on that. And I doubt that they will want someone from either the Baltics, like Kaja Kallas, Estonian prime minister, was rumored to be number one candidate.
She's been fairly open about wanting the job as well.
Indeed, and I think she would do a great job, but I feel that she's a bit too hawkish for the general community, including some of the odds ones out, like Hungary and the likes, who always have something to say, like that one child in the family that's always unhappy about something. So realistically, I doubt that this time around it's going to be a leader from the Eastern Europe, but I think inevitably we are heading that way.
Patty, I have on a couple of occasions asked former Estonian President Kersti Kaljulaid if she thought it was past time that NATO had a Secretary General who was either or both a woman and from somewhere further east, like perhaps a former head of state of one of the Baltic countries. And with a commendably stone-cold face, she replied, there are many excellent candidates who meet those criteria. But four Dutch Secretary Generals we would have had if Mark Rutte gets the job. We would be yet to have a female Secretary General. That seems a little bit overdue as well, doesn't it?
I mean, yes, on the one hand. On the other hand, I think, particularly when it comes to Estonia, I agree with what you were saying. I think she's been way too hawkish to get any kind of consensus on her candidacy, male or female. The other thing about Rutte, which I've heard, and I don't know how big of a factor this is, but that, you know, he's been kind of called the Trump whisperer because back apparently in 2018, when Trump was president, had come in and was very critical of the fact that a lot of European countries were not meeting the NATO threshold. Rutte was kind of the one to talk him down through, I guess, a combination of kind of compliments and such by saying, oh, well, you know, we're doing better and you're the reason. So I think there's some thought that he would be a good candidate in that sense if Trump were to get elected, that he's a veteran, having been around a long time, and so could possibly be up to, you know, a very difficult task if Trump ends up winning the election.
Just as a final thought on this one, Aliona, this is not a happy circumstance for Ukraine, is it? The idea that the next Secretary General of NATO may be chosen largely on their ability to placate an angry toddler.
Well, unfortunately, I think it's up to 300 million Americans who are about to witness an angry toddler as their president. Needless to say, you know, the leader of the free world. So that's not just NATO's problem. I think that's all of ours problem. But let's hope that, you know, as history always plays out in the most positive way, and we can expect some surprises at the end of it.
Well, let's move on to China, where the annual so-called two sessions is underway of the National People's Congress and the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference. The deliberations of both are more or less entirely opaque, but China's premier and approximate second-in-command Li Qiang emerged from behind a scarlet curtain to announce that this year's GDP growth rate would be the same as last year's, i.e. 5%. While plenty of countries would be pretty happy with that, it may be insufficient to revive the enthusiasm for China among foreign investors, even if one is willing to bet one's business on Chinese economic growth figures, which the prudent tend to regard from the end of a barge pole. Patty, first of all, Li did essay what sounded like some startling honesty from somebody in his position, in any government, in fact, never mind China's. I quote, "The foundation for the continuous recovery and improvement of our country's economy is still not solid, with insufficient demand, overcapacity in some industries, weak societal expectations, and many lingering risks." If we assume he's trying to put some sort of gloss on things, how bad are things?
I mean, things have been very difficult in China. There was a kind of double whammy, which, of course, was the pandemic, which hit a lot of countries. But China's, zero COVID policy kept the economy frozen for much longer than a lot of other countries around the world. Secondly, there had been this incredible bubble in its real estate in its real estate sector. And that came crashing down. And that has really been very difficult. It slowed the economy, had a lot of negative effect on consumer sentiment. I think what people were hoping for, at least outside investors were hoping for, was more stimulus from the Chinese government. And that did not seem to be forthcoming. So I think what's also important to recognize is how important China is in terms of the global economy and the regional economy. And if there's a slowdown in China, that's going to mean a slowdown in the region and a slowdown worldwide.
Aliona, how much does a Ukrainian wince when they read of another big increase in China's military spending, up 7.2% year on year again, accompanied with the lines that China will, I quote, unswervingly advance the great course of the motherland's reunification?
Well, that's actually quite a troubling trend that we have been watching for quite some time now, not just worrying for our Taiwanese friends who were extremely supportive of Ukraine, but also seeing and comparing that spending to the European spending and some other states that are still being extremely complacent on the continent. With China providing and supplying Russia with some critical elements, some tech that's critical to their offensive weapons. I think there was an investigation by UK journalists that found that China has been providing helicopters to Russia too, military helicopters. All of that is signaling that that's quite a powerful party to the war now that supports Russia and now aligned with North Korea and Iran. China has become a player to watch for Ukraine quite recently, I would say, surprisingly. But I think as soon as Ukraine has realized its agency on the international stage and perhaps not the wobbleness of the West, but the multilateralism of international relations, that you can't just rely on one strong alliance in the West, that you actually need to talk and engage with everyone. The ambassador to China was appointed just last year for the first time in many, many years when they realized that they need to hold communication channel open. There were many talks that, you know, Chinese companies are already approaching Ukraine with regards to reconstruction in the future. So there's also that concern here in the West, whether Ukraine will open up to Chinese investment and become that source of influence, similarly to the way Balkans or perhaps even Africa did. So China is becoming a strong player, and it's great to see that Ukraine is waking up to that reality along with other states.
Paddy, something we did talk about on yesterday's Daily, but I do want to ask you, as somebody professionally interested in trying to report on Asian economies, as you were just discussing at the top of the show, it's a perhaps minor bit of theatre, but nobody involved in making this decision will be unaware that people will attempt to divine great meaning from it, which is that Lee, contrary to previous practice, is not fielding questions from foreign press this year. Is that the kind of thing that should be causing us to, you know, stockpile tin goods and purchase sandbags?
No, I would not go that far. I mean, it reminds me, I'm old enough to remember, you know, what we used to call the old Kremlinology, when, you know, everybody would try to divine what was going on in the Soviet Union.
Who is sitting two seats closer to the Secretary General than they were last year?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And, you know, in any kind of, particularly in an authoritarian regime where there's an absence of information and communication, you know, everyone's trying to kind of assess what leaders are really thinking. And so, whatever it means, I'm not sure that we know what it means. But in any case, you know, China has been very hostile to foreign journalists. We've had to take out most of our correspondents, as have many other Western outlets, because China won't give visas for journalists. So the idea that there's suddenly some new lack of communication in with the press, I think, is overstating it.
Well, earlier this afternoon, many listeners may have found themselves twitching at a major outage of social media platforms operated by Meta, including Facebook and Instagram, which will have deprived them of their nourishing fix of racist memes from mental uncles, advertisements for sheds, and the inane holiday snaps of someone you vaguely recall meeting at a conference in 2017. That social media has addictive qualities is not in doubt. Indeed, it's how they make a living. But for some users of TikTok, the video sharing platform, which might not be a ghastly data harvesting front run by China's Ministry of State Security, it has begun consuming their lives. Hence, Switzerland's first clinic for TikTok addicts, disappointingly not called Detox. I worked on that for quite a lot of this afternoon. Quite a lot of this afternoon, I worked on that. I did want to start with an opportunity to confess. You first, Alyona, how close are you to requiring its services?
I do not have a TikTok account. I'm very proud of that.
How about the other social media platforms?
Probably all of them. Should I make myself feel good and say that I used to use Instagram but no longer enjoy it and it just sits there as a dead weight? Facebook is still a way to connect with some of Ukrainian friends and former colleagues. Twitter, former Twitter, now X, and LinkedIn are the ones that I use daily in my work.
But if any of them vanished for any particular reason for a period, would you find yourself getting cold sweats or would you just think, nah, other things I can do?
I think I'd be so relieved.
See, I did find myself, Patty, this afternoon just thinking, would it be terrible if Facebook just didn't come back on?
I think the only thing that surprised me about this story is that the clinic opened in Switzerland. I would have just assumed it would have been the United States, maybe California. So it's interesting to me that, you know, Switzerland is kind of the global leader in detox for social media.
Maybe it's just that the Swiss have realized they have actually got a problem and the United States doesn't.
That could be too.
Because just to follow that up, Patty, this is my own pet theory I am interspersing, if that isn't even the word I'm looking for, into the conversation. What we were talking about in terms of the prospect of Donald Trump being unbelievably re-elected president of the United States, none of that happens without social media. Some future Edward Gibbon, when they sit down to write their multi-volume surmise of where it all went wrong for the West, it's going to start with social media, isn't it?
I think it's a huge factor. I mean, basically, it's a megaphone, to put it mildly, on misinformation and disinformation, let's just call it what it is, lies, and purposeful lies, a lot of it. It didn't start with social media. You know, you clearly had that. I think the rise of Fox Network in the United States, which was presenting an alternate reality in many cases for what was going on, really kind of led the way on it. But, you know, once you had this kind of open free-for-all where everybody has their own microphone, and not only that, aside from individuals, you know, you also have state governments, whether China or, and particularly Russia, as we know, that have used it strategically to try and undermine Western democracies and institutions.
Just a final depressing thought for the panel then, Alyona. Do you think we yet fully comprehend what social media has done to people who have been raised on it? I mean, I guess there's, now that I think of it, a positive way you can look at it, i.e. that the people who have been raised on it do actually understand it, possibly better than those who stumbled into it late in life. In fact, I have a friend whose theory is that everything went wrong in about 2005 when the baby boomers retired and their well-meaning children gave them all Facebook accounts so they could keep up with the grandkids, and all of a sudden you have these bored, crazy pensioners who don't really understand how any of this works, and that's how Donald Trump gets elected. But I didn't have a social media account at all until well into my late 30s because I am that ancient. I cannot overstress my gratitude that my entire youth happened offline. Is this breeding a really weird generation of people?
Well, just wait until AI kicks in. And what the generation of our children, for example, of teenagers now who are seeing all the deep fakes, who are creating them, what's that going to turn into with the informational warfares going on? I still think that easing into it with the creation of social media and kind of learning how that works, and now learning how that can be weaponized and used as a tool, whether to alter the outcomes of the elections or start wars or spread hate, or just keep up with your grandchildren. I think that's a useful skill to have. The next stage will be educating ourselves on the usage of artificial intelligence deployed on social media. So I think that the progress is racing ahead, not just going ahead. And it's going to be hard to keep up. But I think the more information we have now, the more exposure there is, the better.
On that vaguely hopeful note, Aliona Livko and Patty Cohen, thank you for joining us. Finally on today's show, to Australia. John Brown was Australia's Minister of Tourism from 1983 until 1987, overseeing an enormous expansion in visitors to the country during that time. He is responsible for effectively launching Global Brand Australia with a series of television adverts starring Paul Hogan.
Come on, come and say g'day. I'll slip an extra shrimp on the barbie for you. Come and say g'day.
Footnote. In Australia, they are prawns, not shrimps, and I never in my entire childhood saw anybody barbecue one. Nevertheless, Monocle's Georgina Godwin caught up with John Brown in Sydney and asked him about his reinvention of Australia's tourism market.
We didn't want this country to be a secret. We had so much to offer, we've got to do something about it. So that's how Shrimp on the Barbie was the start of this extraordinary generation change in Australia, where we went from being nothing to be, in some ways, the tourism toast of the world. I think when he did Shrimp on the Barbie, we were the 67th in the list of countries that people wanted to visit. But in 2 years, we were in the top four. The big change, people suddenly realised down here was this little island continent that nobody knew about, that had so much to give, so much to offer, environmentally, culturally, from a beauty point of view, from a freedom point of view. We had everything to offer the world, and we did.
And, I mean, I love the way that it was written. I mean, the fact that here in Australia you don't say shrimp, you say prawn, but you had to change that for the American market.
Well, it's become part of the American doggerel now. It's very common in America. Put a shrimp on the barbie. Come around to my place. Come a shrimp on the barbie.
And, of course, what it also did was it made Paul Hogan huge in America with the whole Crocodile Dundee series.
Well, what people generally don't know is all that work that Paul did for me, and it wasn't just shrimp on the barbie, all the work he did around Australia, particularly when he had a big pilot strike, and in other places, he did for nothing. He wouldn't take any pay. I had to pay his cheque to the Variety Club for looking after disabled children, of which he was the first barker. So he did all that fun thing. He loved doing it. He's such a patriotic Australian. He just loves this place. And, of course, that gave him a start in America for Crocodile Dundee. And I was so pleased it did, because he'd done all that work for nothing with no intention of finding a gold bag at the end of the rainbow. He just did it. And, of course, Crocodile Dundee is a sensation. It's still in the top two or three choices in the world for cable television.
So, as you say, there really wasn't much of a tourist industry here. Australia languished at the bottom of the table. And then suddenly it became incredibly popular. But how do you build a tourism industry? How do you make sure that you have the infrastructure, for instance, for all these new visitors?
It took a fair bit of work. In 1983, we had 850,000 visitors to Australia per year, mainly VFRs, visiting friends and relatives, usually Pommies, coming here to see their families. And from 1983 to 1987, we went from 850,000 to nearly 3 million visitors a year, which was a sensational rise. And it all happened because suddenly Australia wasn't a mystery anymore. We opened the doors to America, come and see us, and Japan, and England, and Europe. So that was the miracle of it all. We rose so quickly. And that you understand it when you consider you've got something hidden away for so long, such a treasure, and suddenly you open the doors. Of course, people poured in. They're still pouring in.
And they're pouring in particularly this week and last because of Taylor Swift. I've just been looking at some of the figures here, which is quite extraordinary. Something like 66 more flights had to be put on, an increase of 1,500% in Qantas bookings. I mean, the figures are extraordinary. Why do you think that someone like Swift wants to come here, which is so far away from everywhere else in the rest of the world, to do her concerts? And why do people come to them? Have you ever seen a moment like this before?
No, never. It's an absolute phenomenon. And I'm glad she comes here. Beautiful, wholesome young person, role model for kids. And people just flock to her. 66,000 in Melbourne for three nights. No, 80,000 in Melbourne for three nights. 66,000 for Sydney, four nights in a row, doing a three-hour show. And she's thrilled Australia. I mean, there's still a big thrill here. The Tay-Tay thrill is still here with us.
I love that you're over 90 and you're talking about Tay-Tay.
I'm an old larrikin, you know.
But one of the reasons, of course, that she's doing a concert here, or concerts here, is that you made sure the facilities were there. You built the stadiums.
Well, if she'd come in the 80s, performing at an open paddock somewhere, we didn't have anything. We hadn't built a hotel in Sydney in 40 years till Paul let fly with Put a Shrimp on the Barbie, and now we're sitting here in Sydney looking out on what is the most magnificent view in the world. I don't think any country in the world, any city in the world, could match what I'm looking at here, Sydney Harbour and St. Vyrons. Now, it wasn't like this in the 80s. It wasn't. It grew up very quickly. Once we opened the door and let the world see what we've got here, we've been a star ever since.
That was the former Australian Minister of Tourism, John Brown, talking to Monocle's Georgina Godwin. Listen out for a longer version of that interview on Meet the Writers, where John Brown talks about being dubbed the Minister for Fun, dissing koalas, and the fondly remembered Sex on the Desk scandal. That's all for this edition for the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Aliona Hlivko and Paddy Cohen. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by Neoma Ekwe. Our sound engineer was Lily Austin. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.